Welcome to the podcast, Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite. I'm Dr. Laura Sokola, your host, and our focus is on mastering communication as an essential leadership skill so that you can command the room, connect with the audience, and close the deal in any context. My guest this week is Jay Scott. Jay is the CEO of 120 VC, a transformational leadership consultancy. Jay was a high school dropout turned rescue swimmer for the U.S. Navy. He founded 120 VC after only 4 years of experience in the Navy. And after now 25 years in business, his driving philosophy is that success has nothing to do with IQ. Rather, it's about putting in the hard work and surrounding yourself with a team that you inspire to reach for their potential. Jay, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dr. Laura. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Kick us off with a fun fact. Tell us a little something about yourself.
So I love gardening. I think it's a fun fact because if you look at my bio picture, I look like this tough guy, but I love putting my hands in the dirt. I'm a huge fan of lavender. My kids and I planted a micro lavender farm, and every season we harvest it, and that money goes to pay for college.
Oh my goodness, that's amazing. How much area do you have dedicated to micro lavender?
It's a quarter of an acre, and it's just fun because it's pretty. Mosquitoes don't like it. It smells good when you go into the yard, and then we harvest it, and it's like a science experiment for the kids because you have to put it in a still, and there's fire, and it boils, and then the oil, and it separates the water. And so we spend summer evenings grilling outside and making lavender oil.
That's amazing. All right. Well, if you have extra, you know where to send it.
I do.
It's the plant or the oil, especially because God graced me with a black thumb. I do not have a green thumb by any stretch of the imagination. I can kill anything. So it's good to know that there's somebody with a very different skill set. Now, tell us a little bit more about 120 VC. What's your 30-second elevator pitch?
So we've been around 25 years, and what we've done predominantly for the Fortune 500 is take groups of high potential individuals and turn them into a single unified high-functioning team that's focused on accomplishing things that matter. And in business, there's really only three things that matter: improving customer satisfaction, team member satisfaction, and profitability. So the idea is to teach them to focus all of their time on things that will drive those outcomes, which then will in turn drive growth for their business, as opposed to just showing up and doing work for the sake of doing work. We've traditionally focused on groups that are considered SG&A or cost centers, like IT or HR or marketing, and we teach them how to think like business people. So as opposed to, hey, we just have a budget, we're here, we keep the lights on, we do IT, we do marketing, we transform their thought process from we do IT, we do marketing, to we do things that improve customer satisfaction, team member satisfaction, and or profitability, and in that way transform them from this cost center to an epicenter of growth for their companies.
That's awesome. And it's so important. There's so many conversations that I hear from people in all walks of life that so many employees, regardless of role or industry, don't feel connected with what they're doing. They don't feel connected with their company's mission. If someone were to walk up to them and say, what value do you provide? Or what's the relationship? Or what's your contribution to the products that are made or the customer? A lot of them will go, I don't know. I just process HR paperwork.
Right.
Or they don't feel a connection. It's just a job. So it sounds like that's exactly the problem you're trying to fix.
That is exactly the problem that we fix. Because here's the truth. If they can't tell you how they're doing that, meaning improving customer satisfaction or team member satisfaction, they're not.
Yeah.
And so you have a whole group of people there that are just doing work because it's perceived that that's the work that needs to be done. Rationalization of work is probably the least understood, relatively easy thing for an organization or a group in an organization to do to move the needle.
Yeah. And I would imagine it just changes turnover rate. It changes presenteeism as well as absenteeism. You know, who's just showing up and going through zombie-like motions because they don't feel inspired, they don't feel valued, they don't feel like they matter. They're just doing a job.
Totally. And that's the coolest thing about leaders that I don't think leaders know that they're doing. Leaders that are responsible for a winning team, what they've done is they've provided those people with a better quality of life than people that are on teams that aren't getting the necessary and expected results. Like, people on winning teams aren't working weekends. People on winning teams aren't answering their phone during dinner, getting yelled at for answering phone during the dinner. They're not worrying about their economic prosperity. And by the way, human beings fundamentally want to be successful at home, with our friends, with our families, and at work. So when you're on a team that's winning and you know how you're contributing to that win, you have an inspired life compared to people that are struggling to succeed.
Which is a massive difference in culture and in experience for everybody. I would think if one person's going to feel that way, it just has a compounding ripple effect for everybody else that they touch throughout the day.
Yeah.
That's amazing. With building all of this then in the last 25 years, what's the most important leadership communication lesson you had to learn, and how did you learn it?
That there's a difference between advocacy and inquiry. So when we watch leaders on TV or in the movies, they always, on the spur of the moment, come up with some sort of amazing speech, and we're all enthralled, and then we give them 5 stars for the movie and they win Academy Awards. Except for leadership, one, requires preparation, and those actors all had script writers. But two, what they're doing in all of those moments is they're advocating for their position. They're advocating for their point of view. The simple fact is this: no matter how high my IQ is, it's just me. And a leader is truly successful when they can bring a group of people together and leverage the collective IQ, right? Because if we add all of our IQs together, we're much smarter as a group of individuals. And so ultimately, one of my basic rules is now, because, you know, I grew up thinking I needed to be the smartest person in the room. I needed to have all the answers. I needed to get all the solutions. And frankly, that served me. It served me because when I got out of the Navy, the 4 years that I spent in corporate before I started 120 VC, I was exactly that guy. And I got promotion after promotion after promotion after promotion. But at some point, it doesn't scale, right? And it drives potentially my success, but it doesn't drive my team's success. So what I learned was shifting to inquiry. When somebody on my team comes to me and asks me, how should I go about this? What should I do? I point it right back at them and I say, listen, I'm not going to answer your question. I'd like you to tell me what you would do if I wasn't here. What would you do? Because in order for me to be an effective leader, I need to know where they're at. Right? I need to understand where they're at in their mind, what the starting point is, because if I just start telling, I might tell right past them. I might talk right past them. More importantly, they might not have the experience to receive the wisdom that I'm giving, right? So instead of advocating, I inquire a lot more. More importantly, I use active listening, not just to figure out where they're at, but to challenge and ask questions to help them figure it out. So I'll ask, what would you do? They share with me, I would do X, Y, and Z to accomplish this thing. And if in that, I can't see how that'll accomplish the thing that they're trying to accomplish, instead of saying that won't work, which is a judgment and not a fact, and a judgment usually shuts down the conversation, I've learned to say, I don't understand. I don't understand how that's going to get you across the finish line. Would you help me understand? Mm-hmm. People loved to be asked to help. So they're like, no problem. And now I'm invited to say, ask questions like, why would you do that? Or have you ever done that before? And what were the results? And even share back, one time I did that and this is what happened. Has this occurred to you? And this becomes this back and forth where instead of solving the problem for them, I'm just challenging them to help them architect their own roadmap to a shared goal, which does so many things. One, the final approach benefits from both of our experience. Okay, but they came up with it. I teach them and I invest in them in learning how to be an effective problem solver. I also teach them that leadership looks less like advocacy, advocating for my point, advocating for my position, advocating for what I think, than it is inquiry. Last, when it's all done, what did I do? I did the thing that Forbes magazine says a leader's supposed to do. I've set my team member up for success because we both think their idea, the way that they think that they should approach this, is going to work. And then I send them off into the world to be successful.
Where was the inflection point? When did you make that shift between, and my understanding is you're saying advocacy, meaning advocating for your own, no, I'm right, my way is better than your way, I want to see it done my way,
yes.
Versus inquiry saying, help me understand, here's the holes in my understanding of your approach or your idea, help me close those loops. So when did you make that shift and why? What was the trigger?
Before answering that question, I do want to say, Fred Kaufman teaches us that good leadership is a balance of advocacy and inquiry. Mm-hmm. The reason I answered your question with, I learned to inquire more because I was taught that it's all about advocacy.
Sure.
My position.
Sure, sure.
I'm the smartest person in the room. So with that said, there is a balance. If in that interaction, they can't get there, I'm going to teach. I'm going to say, okay, this is how I would go about doing it. Sure. In which case, I'm back to advocacy. When was the inflection point? You know, I'm going to say probably somewhere around 35 years old, within 4 or 5 years of starting my company. I started the business. By starting a business, I mean, I incorporated a business and I was the only employee and I was the CEO.
Sure.
And I was the founder.
Yep.
Okay. And I had no idea how I was going to be successful. And I was lucky enough to get my first engagement through another company at Sony Pictures. And so I remember working there, running large projects. And the reason I had that opportunity is because the CIO that I was at Sony Pictures at the time had moved over from Universal Music, where I had previously worked. And so I had this great opportunity to manage these projects, and it was about me. I was exactly that guy that was like, trying to be the smartest person in the room, solving everything, rescuing everything. And I was playing for me. But every once in a while, I would have these truly human interactions that were collaborative with people. And it felt better. It felt easier, right? Mm-hmm. And over time, I look back a lot, like, what did I do? Was I successful? Was I not successful? How did it feel? How can I improve that? I don't know where I got that. I just am naturally that way. And so I would often look back and play the game film in my mind of situations. And over a period of time, I realized the interactions where I was working with somebody, where I was collaborating with them to come up with a solution, I felt more connected. They were a lot more fun than driving people to accomplish outcomes. And in the end, like, we celebrated together. So it was easier. It felt better. There was more trust. And so somewhere in there, I moved on from Sony, went to DirecTV, started hiring people. And it was probably a couple of years later, I shifted from playing for myself and my customers benefiting from the fact that I was a very successful human being to playing for them. Mm-hmm. I really started feeling very connected to, I'm here to help you be successful, yeah. My clients. I'm here for my team members to help you be successful. Because in the moments where I naturally did that, it felt better, it was easier, there was a better outcome. And it was crazy because I was successful before. But in that shift, my clients went from working with me because I was successful to working with me because they trusted me and that we would succeed together.
Yes.
And it got easier. It got better. The breadth of what I could accomplish with them was much more significant than what I could drive by myself through pure will and tenacity.
Words to the wise, to say the least, that shift from it's all about me, I have to have. And I think people at all stages of their careers feel like, I hear so frequently that people hold back from even contributing in meetings because they don't feel like they have the answer, that their answer or their suggestion might not be right. As opposed to just thinking, well, how could you contribute to the conversation? There's seven other people around this table. Can you contribute a thought, a component, and build towards that collective decision-making process? Why do you have to be the hero who comes in after, while they're all chatting and trying to work stuff out together? Why are you the only one who must put the final period at the end of the sentence and solve the problem and save the day? It's kind of this odd fear that we all have. So I'm actually curious, tell me about an opportunity that you missed because you held back. Why'd you hold back? And if you could have a do-over, what would you have done differently?
It's funny because this is the antithesis of what I was just sharing with you.
Okay.
So I got on this journey where I was playing for my customers. I was playing for my team members. And in there somewhere, I got hooked on servant leadership. And I misinterpreted it like most people do. And I thought it was just be really cool to everybody and they will feel loved and they will perform. Except for people need leaders and managers. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a concept of leaders and managers to be successful. And so in that model, I didn't know how to do, I mean, command and control, accountability, it's very clear. We see it everywhere, but it's also really ugly. And it's a little backwards, meaning that it starts at the breakdown, right? Hey, there's a breakdown. And now we're going to like shame somebody to sort of make sure that they're accountable. We even say we're going to hold them accountable. It's so aggressive, our language around that. Mm-hmm. But I always say, and what I learned on this journey, I didn't know how to deal with that in this new model where we should be cool to everybody. Because I knew shaming people wasn't cool. And it wasn't going to hold anybody accountable.
Right.
I had these moments where my mind was just blossoming and I didn't know what to do with it. And I almost went out of business because I just got cool. And there was no accountability and I didn't know how to do accountability and suddenly nobody was getting the outcomes that we needed. So that was a great lesson.
If we know that the term, for those who've never heard of it, the concept of servant leadership, which is so powerful, we know by your story that it is not just
it is
let
not.
Everybody do whatever they want and, you know, be kind of kumbaya supportive and let's, you know, be nice to everybody. That is not what servant leadership is. So what's the 30-second definition of what servant leadership is?
Here's the thing. I completely abandoned it even though I got super clear on what servant leadership was in my mind, team members would take advantage of it. It meant that I gave and they did not give, was my experience with it. Hmm. And so my definition of servant leadership is that we lead in service of the team and I still believe that.
Yes.
But there's got to be a healthy share of leadership and management, right? And we have to have a culture of discipline, trust, transparency, and accountability. Mm. And so that's the first thing that I cultivate with my clients. So that said, we are very compassionate with team members. We bring them on, we train them, we support them. We are 100% there to help them be successful, but they have to be capable of being successful. They need to have the attitude or the aptitude. Otherwise, they're not going to succeed and it tears the rest of the team down, and it really becomes arduous for them and their manager. So we believe that in addition to setting our team members up for success, providing them with the training and the coaching necessary for them to be successful is equally as important as exiting those that can't or won't quickly.
Yes. Yes. And so great lessons learned out of that. Well, I think that that is a great example of a challenge. And so why don't I give you this opportunity then to challenge our listeners? It's time for the Listener 24-Hour Influence Challenge. So Jay, how would you like to challenge our listeners today to take one step that they can complete within 24 hours to have more influence?
So understanding that our brains are wired to judge. This is good or bad.
Yes.
This is going to work. It's not going to work.
Reflex.
It's nature, not nurture, right? That puts us in a terrible position to inquire rather than advocate, right? And so earlier I talked about the difference between advocacy and inquiry. Mm-hmm. Advocacy is often protecting our own needs. Mm-hmm. Inquiry is exploring somebody else's ideas, and we're naturally built to feel like there's some danger in that, like because mm-hmm. we're going to take better care of ourselves than another person. That said, it makes for terrible leadership. The next time somebody comes to you, and it's going to happen tomorrow, the day after you listen to this, it's probably going to happen today. So for the next 24 hours, when somebody comes to you and says, hey, I think we should do this, and your mind says, that's not going to work, that's a bad idea, don't say it out loud. Don't judge it. Don't say that's not going to work, right? Don't try to protect yourself or them. Instead, get curious. Right? Because judgment, it's an assumption. Have you ever said something was going to work, wasn't going to work, and the other person was like, challenge accepted, and they did it that way anyway, and it worked?
Of course, yes.
So the idea here is the next time your brain says, that's not going to work, ask a question.
Yes.
By first state, I don't understand how that's going to work. Will you help me? And ask questions. Try to get to understand that person's point of view, because that person is an intelligent person. That person has probably been thinking about it much longer than you because they've just brought it to your attention. So there's a reason that that person thinks this is going to work. Find it.
Yes. And there's an expression I heard a million years ago, which is that the person who thinks it can't be done should not interrupt the person doing it.
That's great. Yeah. I like that. I'm going to write that down.
There you go. There's my nugget for the day. The person who thinks it cannot be done should not interrupt the person doing it.
Oh, you've had many great nuggets today, Dr. Laura.
This is going to be a nugget fest, and we'll bring some lavender oil, and it'll just be a great party for listeners from start to finish. Jason, tell me about a communication skill you weren't born with and had to learn.
Empathy.
Why?
What else do you want to know? So, quick backstory. You know, I was a young guy. And I kept making the same mistakes over and over. And so I went to see a therapist. And I was just working through some social challenges I was having where the spouse of my best friend had done something egregious to me. Undoubtedly, nobody would have said that what was done was not egregious. Mm-hmm. But my therapist, and I'm expecting her to just be like, oh my God, that's terrible, J. Scott. Like, oh, like I can't believe she did it to you. And she looked me square in the eye and she said, J. Scott, you completely lack empathy. And this hit me like a giant stone in the chest. But
I couldn't pay you. You're not supposed to say that to me.
I couldn't deny, though, that this person that said this to me is a credible human being, you know, like a doctorate, like, you know? Mm-hmm. And so even though I didn't like what she was saying, I started in my mind exploring it. And it became a great gift to me because what ultimately happened was as I worked through this, at first I was like, why should I try to understand the perspective of this human being that was so terrible to me? But I tried, you know, again, back to that, hey, judging it, saying that's not going to work. It's an assumption. It's not a fact, right? So in my mind, I was making up all these stories why she was terrible instead of asking myself questions like, why would she do that? And a couple of things occurred to me. I don't know that she's heard this story. I mean, she should. A couple of things occurred to me. Like, I really was pretty judgy of her. I was, whether I said it out loud, I never confronted her. And we human beings, we read body language. We're not even aware of we're reading body language. So she probably had the impression that I wasn't a fan and was reacting to that. So I was like, well, God, now I'm owning my place in the situation accidentally because a therapist said something to me, right? And so I'm feeling kind of bad. Like I'm feeling kind of like a jerk. You know, this is I was an unexpected outcome. Mm-hmm. And so the next time I go over their house, she opens the door and I just was like, instead of all that ugly feeling that I had inside me about her, like now I'm empathizing with her position. And I'm like, maybe she's a great person and I created this environment. And I just gave her a big hug. And you know what? She didn't not hug me back. She hugged me back. She leaned into the hug, not in an inappropriate way, Jake, if you're listening. Mm-hmm. you know, she hugged me back and we've had a pretty damn good relationship ever since. Lesson here. Instead of all that ugly emotion that I had bottled up inside me about her, that all went away. It got out of my way. And I was then able to be a better friend, leader, or best friend to my friend, right? So in developing empathy, it allows me to get past, because I'm the leader and the key performance indicator of a leader is I enable my stakeholders to define and deliver the necessary and expected results. Mm-hmm. So if I can't get past my own stuff to help them do that, I'm not going to be a very effective leader. So empathy has become a secret weapon and a blessing because yes. I'm not stuck with all that judgment. I'm not stuck with all that nastiness. I really am on an exploration that's curious. Like, oh, wow, that person just acted that way. I wonder what's going on there, which probably also led me to my belief that human beings fundamentally crave success at home, with their friends, their family, and in the workplace. And so when they do something that just seems insane, I'm like, I get really curious. And it allows me to, again, evoke that inquiry first, which might lead to some advocacy to mm-hmm. kind of help them through it and guide the situation. But without empathy, there are so many people that I wouldn't be able to lead because I couldn't interact with them because I wouldn't be interested in their side. And I can't, as a leader, not be interested in where they're at because I have to know where they're at before I can lead them.
Right. Right. I think people are only willing to be led if they feel understood. Otherwise, you're just driving them. And that's a very different state of engagement.
Yeah, like their airline. People choose who they follow.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Well, then tell me about a time when you had to speak up as the lone voice of dissent or disagreement. What happened?
That's my job. That's every day. And it's because I know one of your usual questions is like about the DISC profile, the Myers-Briggs. I ascribe to a much more simple profile, which starts with two fundamental perspectives, and that's the perspective of the challenger and the perspective of the connector. Both have strengths, right? And both have, let's say, opportunities for improvement. I'm talking nature. This is how we're born. Obviously, life gives us perspective. And a lot of your listeners are probably going to be like, I live in where the circles overlap.
In the overlap.
I live where the circles overlap. And so I've got this challenger, this connector, and where the circles overlap, they're both taking place from each other's positives or mm-hmm. each other's strengths. But let me talk about where we're born. People are either born a connector, and so they are born with natural sense of empathy. They navigate the world on relationship. Like my daughter is that, I don't even know where she got it, but from a very early age, young, probably like 2 or 3, as soon as she started communicating, she'd see something and she'd say to people, oh, I love your shoes, or I think that button is really pretty. And then they would be like, oh my God, you're so cute. Thank you for that. And then she'd ask them questions. And I just was, my mind was blown because I had to learn to be this. We already know where I fit. The non-emotionally intelligent person over here, like the non-empathetic. So I'm important in the challenger group, but don't worry, we have our strengths. So anyway, we've got these connectors and they're wonderful with people. Everybody loves them. They're great individual contributors, but they don't want to say no to anybody. Mm. They can't set productive boundaries. They struggle to give clear feedback. They live in what Kim Scott, author of Radical Candor, would call ruinous empathy. Okay, so not great leaders. Yeah. Over here, we've got the challengers. These are the people we call the A types. They're driven. They don't understand why anybody's crying about it. Let's just get the work done. Like, we can do this, you know, and we'll even be cheerleaders if people are on board with getting it done. But if they won't, we'll just kind of leave them behind.
Right.
After years of living in that group and also having to develop empathy, I figured out why they call them A types. And there's no B type. It's just A type, right? People yes. don't like them. Mm. They don't like them. They lack the strengths of the connector. And so nobody's going to follow, to your point earlier, somebody that they don't like, that they don't think is playing for them, that is just playing for the mission and themselves. So if we come together and the challengers, you know, can adopt this emotional intelligence, this empathy, right? They can operate in the middle where the circles overlap. And now they've merged their strength with the connector's strength. And then the connector can get over the fact that happiness is not the goal. Success is the goal. Anything that's worth doing is going to be challenging and people are going to feel that pressure. It's called dynamic tension. I'm struggling.
Creative tension.
Well, there's the creative tension. Anyway, there's this tension, right?
Yep.
But once we can together get past the obstacles and we start succeeding, everybody's feeling good and everybody will be happy in the end. So the connectors just have to tell themselves, look, I have to take a line that seems tough for me from where I'm coming from as a connector, but I'm playing for the team. It's for everybody's own good. Like, I'm doing it for everybody. Sure. And in that way, because now again, what are you doing? You're leveraging your emotional intelligence. You're leveraging the fact that you want to connect. You are doing it for them and yourself, right? They're leveraging the strength of the challenger with their natural, because nobody ever gets mad at a connector. It's funny. I love working with connectors because where their line, it's too hard, is so far from too hard. Because I know too hard, push too hard, right? And so I'm like, listen, I get it. I get you're like, I can't say that, but nobody's going to get mad at you. Yeah. Like everybody loves you. Just go say it.
Yep.
And no matter what, they're going to be like, oh, they're playing for me. I have to work hard because no matter what I say in my natural state, they're like, is he playing for me? Like, who's he playing for, right?
Right. The connectors, you know that they're out for the collective good.
Yeah. And a challenger could be, most of us are too. You know, we want to be successful. We just lack the kinder general traits of like empathy. Anyway, so I have a tendency and I have to be careful. And this is a model that I use with my customers. Teams have to be balanced. And so I have a tendency to surround myself with connectors. Like my wife is a connector. My best friend since I was 11 is a connector. My head of operations is a connector. And so if I don't watch out, my team ends up imbalanced and I'm the person that's always like, we're not going to do that. The voice of reason, that doesn't make any sense. My team will come to me, they'll have conflict with each other. And if I'm not paying attention, I get sent in when really they should just work together to figure it out.
So you have to figure out which side of those two concentric circles you need to tip on. It's one thing to have that great balance in the middle, but sometimes you got to lean to one side or the other. And that can be a moment.
I was going to say, that's the other cool thing about the model. First of all, it's really easy to pick them out, who's naturally the challenger. Because you know what, if you're successful in any way, you're living in that leadership zone in the middle most of the time. You've kind of figured it out without putting a name to it. But under stress, we fall back to sort of our natural tendencies.
Right.
And so it's easy to decide, and I'm going to deal differently with being a challenger. When I have to give critical feedback to a connector, I'm going to inquire. I'm going to ask a lot of questions. I'm going to allow them to retro it. And usually they'll do that. I ask permission. If I were to do that with a challenger, they'd out of courtesy, let me go for like 120 seconds. And then they'd say, hey, Jay, I'm a grown person. You could just say it. Like, what are you trying to say?
Yeah.
Right? They'll prompt me. And so with that, if I know who they are, I can just figure it out in like a 2-minute conversation. I get it right. But it's also really easy to correct because if I came on too strong with a connector, I'd see it in their body language right away.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, oh, and I could adjust. If I come on too soft with a challenger and I don't pick it up in their body language, like, what's he trying to say? They'll tell me. So it's a really easy tool to use. And it's why I prefer it over the, like the Myers-Briggs or the DISC.
Sure.
It allows me to show up in a way that they need me to show up based on where they're coming from or how they navigate the world.
Yes. Yes. And Jason, there've been so many amazing nuggets to take away from today. Really, nugget is to me a reductive word.
Nugget fest.
Nugget fests are great, but there's a lot bigger pieces and stories and values to take away rather than those little nuggets. With all of that, before we wrap this up, is there anything that you'd like to give our audience today?
Yes. One of the books that I've written is titled, It's Never Just Business, It's About People. It's basically my journey, the disaster that my journey from command and control leader through servant leadership to transformative leadership, all the mistakes not all of them, but as many as I could fit in a book that you would read in a reasonable amount of time. All the mistakes that I made, what I learned from them, how I corrected them, and the tools that I use today to get it right.
Mm.
And so I gave you, Dr. Laura, a URL that you could, I guess, put in the bio and then people can go and—
Yes, we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, and download it at no cost. And hopefully that will help you avoid some of the terrible, terrible things that I did as an early manager, leader.
Well, that's amazing. And so it's not just like a free chapter or an outline or a summary or a tip sheet. It is the entirety of the book that you're giving an e-copy to. Is that correct?
Yes.
Love it. And say the name of the book one more time for everybody to hear.
It's Never Just Business. It's About People.
Beautiful. So everybody in the show notes, go down and be sure to download that gift from Jay to you. Jay, it's been such a pleasure. How can people learn more about you and 120 VC?
120 VC is www.120vc.com. And my leadership speaker website is jasonscottleadership.com. They both are driving in the same direction, but have a little bit different content. One's about me, which isn't as interesting as the other one, which is about what 120 VC does. So just decide kind of what you're looking for.
I think people should go to both and learn about both. And they're going to get more value from both when they put it all together and into context. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jay. I've loved every minute of it.
Thank you, Dr. Laura. It's been great.
And to everybody else out there, Thank you for tuning in as always. Be sure to subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or your platform of choice so we can help even more people to increase their confidence, presence, and influence. And finally, of course, if you want to download my free guide to equipment recommendations for virtual influence, including my picks for microphones, lights, and more, go to speakingtoinfluence.com. I'm Dr. Laura Sokola, and you're listening to Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite.
Thanks for listening to Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite, the show for leaders who want to speak with impact. The hosts, producers, owners, and media distributors of the show make no guarantees that the strategies and information discussed will result in profit or other success and may result in losses. The opinions and statements of the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the owners, staff, managers, broadcasters, or sponsors of the show. No medical or psychological therapy or personal or professional wellness or relationship advice is offered in the show. You are advised to seek counsel on matters related to your health, family, relationships, job, or other business and legal matters from licensed advisors in those areas prior to making any changes in business or lifestyle. No information provided may be suitable in your situation. As always, take responsibility for the decisions and actions you take, including the reactions they may make in your work, family, health, and life.